to his latest piece, No Joe, Joe Biden's Disastrous Legislative Legacy. I'll be speaking in Denver, Colorado on March 15th, Friday night, 7 at East High School. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 4:59, and coming up after these messages is your 5 o'clock news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world on Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland. Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world is a book release and talk by urban architect George Crandall. He'll discuss Portland growth, congestion, and global warming, and identify steps the community can take to shape an equitable and resilient Portland. Again, that's Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world, on Thursday, March 14th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, 147 Northwest 19th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has been working to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Blue Mountains in Eastern Oregon Cascades since 1991. This annual benefit party features DJs, speakers, cider, and more. Again, that's the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 North East Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland students will start learning about the Holocaust.
California Gavin Newsom has put the death penalty on hold there.
And Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says two cyber attacks originating in the U.S. cities of Chicago and Houston took out his nation's power last week.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Yesterday, President Trump signed a broad public lands bill that conserves one of the last and largest old-growth forests in Oregon's Coast Range, while also protecting hundreds of miles of rivers throughout the state. The new Devil's Staircase Wilderness, 30,000 acres between the Umpqua and Smith Rivers, is home to bears, otters, and spotted owls, as well as colossal Douglas firs and hemlocks. The bill also adds 256 miles of Oregon waterways where steelhead and salmon spawn to the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System, including parts of the Molalla, Elk, and Chetco. Oregon's entire congressional delegation, including Republican Greg Walden, voted for the bill.
The Oregon Senate overwhelmingly approved a measure requiring schools to teach students about the Holocaust and other acts of genocide. Senators voted 27-0 yesterday to include the Holocaust as part of the statewide social studies curriculum. A recent poll found that two-thirds of American millennials surveyed could not identify what Auschwitz was. Only 10 states require some level of Holocaust and genocide education in the classroom. The measure will now go to the House for approval.
A Portland Public Schools parent was arrested yesterday by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero announced that the district supports the parent. For other immigrant parents in the crosshairs, quote, "We have your back," Guerrero said at the school board meeting last night. Guerrero also said, quote, "I'm horrified. I'm angered that one of these detainees is a PPS parent who, like so many of us, was on their way to drop off their children at school. This is unforgivable and it's inhumane. ICE said they cannot confirm or deny the arrest.
A fundraiser turned sour for Marcom Elementary School earlier this month. During an auction to raise funds for the school, the principal agreed on a last-minute item where parents could buy their child's teacher for the next academic year. The Oregonian newspaper reported today, after a records request, that other teachers complained to the principal that it's wrong to let rich parents purchase their child's way into a better classroom. The school refunded the money raised from auctioning the teachers. The school fundraiser brought in more than $50,000.
Oregon's backlog of rape kits has been eliminated, and state officials say the results are more prosecutions. Oregon was one of 20 states that received part of a national grant to process untreated rape kits, which had been warehoused for years. Almost 3,000 kits around Oregon were tested, and officials say hundreds of new DNA profiles have been added to the national database. But those DNA matches have led to only 6 convictions across the state. Officials say they were able to enter 882 DNA profiles into the FBI's National CODIS database. More than half of those profiles matched those already in the database.
FLIR Systems is expanding its operations from Oregon to Virginia, but they are not saying that they're removing their headquarters. The company makes infrared thermal imaging, used in weapon systems. The Oregonian reports today that the corporation will still refer to its Wilsonville campus as, quote, headquarters. The 350 workers will keep their jobs, but the company's executive leadership will relocate to its new office in Arlington, Virginia. FLIR has gone in recent years by purchasing military robotic and drone weapon manufacturers. Last month, FLIR announced that it had signed a $39.6 million contract to build pocket-sized reconnaissance drones for the U.S. Army.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has no answers, just more questions.
How can I care about rich folks buying their kids into good colleges when the government tried to lie us into a war with Venezuela and the media spread that lie with true belief and gusto? When Trump's new budget shreds Medicare, SNAP, and the EPA while giving the Defense Department more than it can spend and tripling the cost of that wall? How can this be a democracy when one man, Mitch the Itch, I'd like to scratch out completely, can kill any bill he wants? With all the ugly hulks sprouting in and near downtown, visitors will be surprised to find a river there. Maybe the city will fund affordable housing, selling naming rights to the Willamette. Nike River, Amazon River. Does it matter who's the next president when the actual powers won't let her or him get us back to democracy, back to a functioning planet? Spring is almost here. Crocuses are all over. Many plants have bud tips showing. And after spring comes summer. How soon will the fires start this year? How close will they be? With paradise reduced to ashes, where's next? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Sometimes policy decisions get made that impact whole communities for generations without the people realizing it. Exclusionary zoning is one of those policy decisions. Repealing exclusionary zoning, lessons from Minneapolis, Seattle, and our own backyards, is a subject of a special event Thursday night at the EcoTrust building. The goal is more affordable housing. Here to explain what it's all about is Michael Anderson from the Sightline Institute and Bandana Shrestha from AARP Oregon. Thanks for being here with us tonight. Firstly, Michael, what is the exclusionary zoning and how has it impacted Oregon?
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here. I'll back up a little bit and say what zoning in general is. It's this concept basically invented in Germany. It says you can put a factory here and a house there, but you can't put them in the opposite place unless somebody says it's okay. Normal enough idea. Once that spread around the world and came to the United States, one of the things we did with it, unfortunately, was to come up with other less good ways to use it. For example, we said that if your ancestors happened to be from China or Africa or Italy, in some cases, you couldn't live in a certain place, right? At different times, those rules were said differently. So that was racial zoning. And the Supreme Court struck that down in the 19-teens. Soon after that, people started looking for other ways to enforce segregation, to say you weren't allowed to live in certain areas. And one of the ideas that was advanced for doing that was to say, well, what if we had a minimum amount of land that you had to own or rent in order to live in a certain part of town? And what if those parts of town just happened to be the well-off and whiter parts of town? It wasn't always done that consciously, but that was the effect, was that it enforced segregation legally in a way that made it look as if it wasn't a law about race or class, even though it obviously was indirectly. So the idea of exclusionary zoning was sort of a phrase that was coined in the late 60s during the Fair Housing Act conversation, when we had struck down, the Supreme Court and Congress had struck down the various official barriers to racial segregation, but people started to talk about, well, but people still can't live where they want to. What is stopping that? And so exclusionary zoning is a concept for like deliberately sort of setting an area of town where somebody can't afford to go to.
Bondino, would you add anything to what Michael has just said about how exclusionary zoning has impacted Oregon thus far?
No, I don't think I have much more to add. You know, the great thing is that we have knowledgeable people like Michael. I happen to be a generalist. I don't know also a lot about zoning, but I think it has impacts not only, like if you look at it today, it's not only people of color or people from certain backgrounds who are impacted. There are unseen consequences that are impacting people of all ages and abilities. And obviously being from AARP, our membership is people 50 plus, and we care about people who are getting older and how their families are impacted. And here we are involved in this issue of how housing is been, you know, determined that this type of people should live in this place or these types of housing is built in these kind of places. So there is a lot more to exclusionary zoning than just thinking about people of color or people of certain backgrounds.
Yeah, I would say that they may have been designed to separate, but they've also had a bunch of other dumb consequences.
Right.
Yeah. Like in addition to the original one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, let's take this down to earth for a minute. I'm curious, you mentioned, of course, AARP represents older Oregonians. Can you paint the picture a little bit as far as, you know, these are negative impacts, they're adversely affecting people's lives. What does that mean? Is that an elderly person that can no longer afford to live in their neighborhood, or what are you talking about?
Yes, exactly. That is definitely one of the consequences. So, you know, when you think about housing and how our communities are designed, like Michael said, exclusionary zoning might not have been even a term. It's a term that's been coined much later, but the overall impact is our neighborhoods are designed in such a way that it's built for people who are making certain incomes or who live a particular lifestyle. So as you grow older, one of the things we know is people want to stay in their own home and their community as long as possible. But the nature of the kind of communities that exclusionary zoning has resulted in are communities which are very single family home design. They are maybe larger homes. They're homes where people are going to have a harder time aging in place. They're probably going to be more expensive. So if you're somebody who's getting older, you're likely going to be living on a more fixed income. So you're not going to be able to afford to live in that same place where you maybe raised your family. So people might not be thinking about that it really does have an impact on them. And on the other hand, you know, it's not just about you and your future. If you're an older adult, you're also talking about your loved ones, your younger family members who may want to, you know, put their roots down in the same places that they grew up. And, you know, people are not making the same type of incomes that their parents and grandparents are making. They're not going to be able to afford the same types of homes. So that exclusion works in many, many unintended ways and has impacts for people of all ages and abilities.
Michael, how does Oregon compare to other municipalities in terms of housing and policy solutions regarding this issue?
Oregon's actually been pretty progressive on this issue, starting in the 1970s. A lot of people know about the urban growth boundaries. We established that you can't put in urban level of development into what was formerly farmland without sort of comprehensive planning to see if it's necessary. And one of the things that people don't realize as often about the law, but was a huge deal at the time, was that the same law said, also, you need to reduce some of these exclusionary barriers to building in communities. We need to be zoning for mobile parks. We need to be zoning for people of all incomes, not just people of all incomes within a city, but the average Oregonian needs to be able to live in, and the below average or like income Oregonian needs to live in a certain area. And there needs to be a range of options within every community. And Oregon's actually been pretty good at that, but obviously not perfect.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this event that's coming up. Who's organizing it and what's going to happen?
Well, there are three or four organizations, depending on how you look at it. We are working together. ARP is working with Sightline Institute, Thousand Friends of Oregon, and Portland for everyone to put this event together. And it's actually a three-part series. So this is the second event. We had the first one last week called Building More Housing. And next week on Thursday, we will have another one called Subsidizing Housing.
And do you want to talk for a minute about how the first one went or anything interesting that bubbled up in the discussion?
Well, I'll start, and Michael can jump in because he was the facilitator and moderator of this excellent panel. We had panelists come from Vancouver, BC, and a couple of folks from California who came up, and they were really talking about how we can expand housing options and learn from what's happened in Vancouver, BC, and California, including San Francisco, where the housing prices have gone, you know, so high that people who are middle-income families are not able to really live there, and there are groups, including, you know, California YIMBY, the group that we had a speaker who talked about some of the strategies that they've taken, and Gil Kelly, actually, who used to work here in the city of Portland, had insights for us to share from what Vancouver's doing. And I was particularly excited to hear that they were not only talking about building more housing generally, but also that they're thinking more intentionally about housing and accessible housing, meaning housing accessibility, which was really exciting.
Yeah, I thought it was really useful. I love the title of the speaker series, We're Not Doomed Yet. The idea is to bring in good ideas about what we can do here while we have time to avoid the fate of California, among other places, I would say.
Yeah.
Michael, and this is part of a series, so what other events are part of that, and where will they be held?
Yeah, so Mandana mentioned that we did the one last week, and we'll do the one a week from tomorrow, also a Thursday event, Subsidizing Housing Effectively. That'll have folks from New York and also Vancouver. A couple folks from other cities coming in talking about the ways to create deeply affordable and below market housing, I think, for people who have lower incomes.
And what's the format? Does the audience ask questions?
Yeah, it's a panel, so it's some presentations, some moderated questions, and some audience questions.
One great thing is that folks who come can not only ask questions, but they are invited to follow up and join us for a happy hour afterwards and really have an opportunity to engage with some of these real good thought leaders who are doing interesting things in their communities, as well as really smart people here from Portland.
Yeah, and it's free.
Yes.
Well, I'm curious as well. A city could really be on board with some of these concepts, but how do you bring along developers or people that are, you know, in Portland, you can see there's tons of people who now work construction, and they aren't necessarily benefiting from all this exclusionary zoning, but they do rely on it for their income. So there's all these kind of competing interests. And I'm curious how you bring people like developers and other stakeholders along who might like it the way it is.
I guess I would say that's a good point about people who build buildings not always being able to afford the buildings that they're working on. I think that's totally right. And but it's not necessarily the case, right? Ultimately, the solution is we need a variety of new homes. We need to keep up with population. And I think what we need to do is rethink our laws in ways that tap the energy of people who are good at building homes, including developers who are doing the paperwork, but also people who are swinging the hammers and raising the rafters, who can, it's possible to build homes more cheaply that are not McMansions, right? So one of the problems with Portland's law, that the way exclusionary zoning manifests today, is that it's perfectly legal to take a like $300,000 house at the end of its useful life that was built in 1906, there's one across the street from me, and knock it down and put a McMansion up that's like a 4,000 square foot thing. In fact, that's the only thing that you're allowed to build. If you wanted to put three of those little homes that are newer and sell for the same price because they get to split up the land cost three ways, you're not allowed to. So like, if we legalize triplexes, you could do a building that's the three times the size of the tiny old one, has about the same price because it has lower land costs and would be affordable to a middle-income Portlander, like somebody who maybe has a construction job. So I think it's about making legal the things that can build a new industry that's more has more inclusive results. And it's also about figuring out the ways to ensure that we also use public money to support people who need help to remain housed.
And this is a question to both of you. Are there other parts of the United States that you think that Oregon should aspire to in regard to zoning policy?
Well, you know, I mean, we have a speaker who's going to be coming from Minneapolis, who they just passed zoning law where they allow more units, I guess, you know, fourplexes. That's something that we are not there yet. I think we are doing pretty good, but I think there are some places who are some cities that are doing. And so some of the folks that who are coming to visit with us and be part of the series, they have lots of great examples. And maybe Michael can talk about some of the examples you might think about.
Sure. Yeah, I think Minneapolis is a good example. And there are certainly others. I like to say that the model that we all have, like the best model for doing things right, is actually us. Mm. 100 years ago.
Yep.
So when most of the cities in the United States were built, we did not have exclusionary zoning policies. And that is why cities exist, right? That is why suburbs today look different from other cities that are older. It's not that things were great then. Like I said, there was terrible racial discrimination among many other problems at the time. But because we were using those overt types of discrimination, we hadn't yet tried to hide those impulses inside the zoning code. Mm. Now it would be great if we could take the non-bad zoning from before and pair it with the non-bad everything else that we've been working on for 100 years and have a more inclusive, equitable city, I think.
And I think one of the results of that is the kind of community and probably neighborhoods we all want to live in. Places that are walkable, places with lots of different types of housing options, people of all ages and abilities, incomes, races, everybody who you'd want to be friends with and who have the opportunity yes. to live in the kind of community. So that's the kind of, I think that's what we have to end with, is that that's the kind of community we're hoping to be able to create.
And if we're sitting in one. This yes. is the Buckman neighborhood, has all kinds of small unit homes that were built before we made it illegal to do that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, Bandana and Michael. That was Michael Anderson and Bandana Shrestha from AARP Oregon speaking to us about exclusionary zoning. Thank you.
And just, we just have a few seconds left. Do you want to give us the time and location of the upcoming event once more?
Yes. It's tomorrow, Thursday, 5:30 at EcoTrust.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
California Governor Gavin Newsom ended his state's death penalty with an executive order today, granting reprieves to 737 people on death row there. California accounted for around a quarter of the people facing execution in America and has not executed anyone in over 10 years, largely because of legal challenges. A longtime opponent of capital punishment, Newsom noted that more than half of those on California's death row are people of color, and that five people sentenced to death in the state had later been exonerated. As California now joins Colorado, Pennsylvania, and Oregon in placing a moratorium on the death penalty, there are still 30 states in the U.S. that have capital punishment.
I moved forward just moments ago with an executive order advancing a moratorium on the death penalty in California. This has been that began with an introduction of an elderly man named Pete Pianese. He was about 10 or 11 years old, and my grandfather introduced me to Pete. My grandfather had made it a life pursuit to address the injustice of Pete's arrest and prosecution for a crime he did not commit. Pete later became known as the Bum Rap Kid. He was set up by the mob, set up to be executed, save for one individual on a jury that held out just on moral grounds, was absolutely convinced in Pete's guilt, sentenced Pete to two life sentences, but did not believe in the death penalty. Pete Pianese would not have survived had it not been for that individual. I was a young man learning that life story, and I also got to know Pete up until his dying days. And I also had the opportunity in that spirit to start thinking and to reflect on the death penalty, on its purpose, and on the passion that arises when we debate the issue. I had the opportunity for the course of years to listened to people on all sides of the aisle, visited San Quentin, went on death row, met in San Quentin a young man that was there that I went to high school with. The warden said he's actually a pretty good kid, but he killed his mom. I had a foster brother that spent time in San Quentin for crack cocaine dealing. Got to understand the racial disparities in 5-year mandatory minimum sentences for crack cocaine versus 5,000 grams of powder cocaine that would require that same minimum mandatory. I've gotten a sense over the course of many, many years of the disparities in our criminal justice system. I lived through the super predator generation. 3 strikes and you're out. We went to this mass over-incarceration, and now the pendulum's swinging in a new direction. But all the while, we had this fourth thumb that stood out in California, and that is we were laying claim to having the largest death row in the Western Hemisphere, the largest death row in the United States of America, 2 times the size of the next largest state, Florida. Doesn't necessarily square with, I think, the values that are represented in the folks behind me and represented in the hearts and minds of tens of millions of Californians. I think we're better than this. 120 people have died, either of suicide or natural causes, including someone last week. Just 13 have been executed. And you, as taxpayers, you have spent $5 billion since we reinstated the death penalty in this state. What have we gotten for that? You had someone just last year that was released from death row after serving 26 years. Since 1978 in this country, 164 people have been exonerated from death row, 5 now in California. What we're being tasked to do, and let me sum up, in California is to consider the following. To consider executing more people than any state in modern American history. To line up human beings every single day for execution for 2+ years. To line people up to be executed, premeditated, state-sponsored executions, 1 a week for over 14 years. That's a choice we can make, or we can make, I think, a more enlightened choice to advance justice in a different way. There was a National Academy of Science report that came out that estimates 1 out of every 25 people on death row is innocent. If that's the case, that means if we move forward executing 737 people in California, we will have executed roughly 30 people that are innocent. I don't know about you. I can't sign my name to that. I did this with a heavy heart, with deep appreciation for the emotions that drives this issue. And I did it with the victims in mind. I met a mother who said, "How dare you? You have no right to do this to my family. You won't be doing this for my family. You'll be doing this to my family. You have no right to take another life in the name of my daughter who was murdered." We are no longer going to support the injection protocol, and we are, as I speak, shutting down, removing the equipment in the death chamber at San Quentin, symbolically and substantively, to send a message that we're better than this.
At this hour, an extreme winter storm centered over the Colorado Front Range has unleashed hurricane-force winds across the Plain States and upper Midwest. It's being called a bomb cyclone, and it's packing winds, severe blizzard conditions, and flooding. Blizzard warnings currently stretch nearly 800 miles from northeast Colorado to northwest Minnesota. Residents say the storm evolved from a regular winter event to a historic cyclone in just 24 hours. The Washington Post reports this afternoon that the storm's central pressure dropped 33 millibars since yesterday, officially making it a meteorological bomb, also known as an explosive cyclogenesis. This morning, hurricane-force gusts hit Dallas at 78 miles an hour, as well as Denver at 80 miles an hour, and Colorado Springs at almost 100 miles an hour during a blinding snowstorm. The National Weather Service described it as a, quote, "Great Plains cyclone of historic proportions."
Yet another wildfire has been found to have been caused by power lines. Investigators today said Southern California Edison power lines touched off the 2017 Thomas Fire. The Thomas Fire burned more than 280,000 acres in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, killing 2 people. The fires later triggered a mudslide that killed 20 more people. The investigation found that two power lines slapping together during high winds started the blaze in December of 2017. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection and Ventura County Fire Department investigators spent more than a year on the investigation. The utility company admitted last October that its equipment probably ignited at least one starting point to the fire. But today's announcement means that Southern California Edison is responsible for $1.3 billion in insurance claims from fire victims, as well as $400 million in claims from the mudslides.
Recent changes to federal regulations help protect ground and surface water from toxic pollutants. It's time for Current Cast.
Cole Ash goes to court on this Current Cast. When coal is burned for power, a residue called coal ash is left behind.
It contains a slew of toxic pollutants such as arsenic, cadmium, and selenium.
Lisa Hallowell of the nonprofit Environmental Integrity Project says utilities used to frequently dispose of coal ash in unlined ponds that could leak into ground and surface water. But in 2015, coal ash disposal was federally regulated. New impoundments must be lined to minimize risk.
We finally do have federal regulations, which is great.
And a recent court decision mandates that older unlined impoundments must retrofit or close.
Which will be safer for all of the communities that live near these sites.
CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
A new report on rising sea levels indicates that by the end of this century, water damage in California will be, quote, far more devastating than the worst earthquakes and wildfires in state history, end quote. The report by U.S. Geological Survey scientists examined sea level rise combined with storms, wave action, cliff erosion, beach loss, and other coastal threats across California. It found that the number of people exposed to danger is three times greater than previous models that considered only sea level rise. More than 500,000 Californians and $150 billion in property are at risk of flooding along the coast by 2100. That's equal to 6% of the state's gross domestic product and comparable.